Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from the car company Scion. As part of its Motivate program, Scion invited 50 semifinalists to LA, where they were provided mentors, attended seminars, and met with advisors. Then, the 10 that most improved received $10,000, a Scion, and continued access to mentors. You can track their success at scion.com.
Today in Studio 360, a fantastic new musical with a very unlikely hero, Imelda Marcos.
Imelda loved to visit Studio 54. She had a disco ball in her apartment and a dance floor in Manila on her roof.
Tyrant's wife by day, disco queen by night. The show is Here Lies Love, and I'll talk with Alex Timbers, one of the most innovative directors working in theater today. And we'll hear about another play, this one put on by a company of deaf actors, in total silence.
The world that doesn't have exposure to deaf culture will see the play and will let go of their fear.
Plus dreamy pop songs from the young Brazilian artist Dom La Nena. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and lots more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, we'll have a live performance from Dom La Nena, a performer originally from Brazil whose delicate songs are nothing like the Brazilian music you know. Necesito aire, solo quiero el aire, que por respirar si desde lejos me mandas. That's later in the hour, but first...
To all law enforcement entities, this is not an admission of guilt. I am speaking to my family now.
Shows like Breaking Bad make it easy to feel that we are living in a golden age of TV, but that golden age is happening on cable. When it comes to broadcast network programming, things are looking a lot less wonderful. Right now is the moment every year when the big four networks throw splashy parties for advertisers and the press to announce their new shows for the fall.
Hey, honey, how's ninth grade? You having fun? You need advice about boys?
What's happening right now?
I'm single parenting.
That was a clip from Sean Saves the World, a new NBC comedy set to premiere this fall. But notwithstanding all the hoo-ha surrounding the announcements, the networks are seriously struggling. Their share of the primetime TV audience has been declining steadily for a quarter century, a few percent a year. But in just the last year, the audience shrank, apparently, by a sixth. We may have arrived at some kind of tipping point. And here to help me figure this out is Joe Adalian. He is the West Coast editor for New York Magazine Online. Joe, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So this eclipse of network TV is a tale well told, but it does suddenly seem to have gone from slowish decline to free fall. What's going on?
Well, it has not been a good season for the broadcast networks. That's absolutely true. You had no new big giant hits that launched this year. Fox's American Idol lose a quarter of its audience in one season, which made its ratings overall go down quite a bit. You know, NBC struggled mightily this year. I mean, NBC in the first quarter of 2013 fell off the earth. Without The Voice, which is their big reality show, without NFL football on Sundays, there were times when NBC would finish 10th in the ratings. I don't know, though, however, that this was a tipping point necessarily. Maybe we'll look back. Broadcast TV still has its ability to generate more shows that a lot of people talk about than even cable. Cable this year has done great with some of its biggest shows getting even bigger. The Walking Dead exploded. Game of Thrones on HBO got bigger. Duck Dynasty suddenly came out of nowhere. But network TV is still sort of the biggest game in town, and I think that it's easy to get overexcited about it.
Well, and I suppose part of it is the fact that people like us who talk about culture and television and maybe people who listen to public radio tend to watch the cable shows. And so it feels like, oh, that's the new world. Networks are over more than they really are because they still have audiences.
Well, certainly the networks are very much in danger if they haven't already lost the war for buzz and for its stranglehold on pop culture. That's absolutely true. I mean, but even cable is losing some of that as well now. I mean, one of the most talked about shows this year has been House of Cards. It didn't air on any sort of television network. It aired online on Netflix.
Right.
So some of the same things that have hurt network TV are now going to start hurting cable as well. But absolutely, network TV has become in many ways sort of in its programming philosophy not too far afield from, say, at Walmart. And Walmart makes billions of dollars every year, but they don't necessarily get talked about. One thing that's going to have to happen is that networks have to figure out a way to go into year-round programming, and they're starting to do that. They can't just continue to take many, many weeks off.
But they still do it. Why haven't they, one of them at least, broken out of that and said, you know, we can change this model. There's nothing sacred about it.
A little bit of that has happened, but there's still an amazing incentive to sell a lot of money in the fourth quarter to advertisers. They like that, and it's a hard habit to break, as it were.
But they've got to look at this, like, 17% cut in the attractive demographic and primetime audience and say, holy cow, this isn't just the same old decline we've all spent our entire careers experiencing.
It was a really bad year. There's absolutely no denying that. The response to that is, let's make a lot more shows. So even CBS, which historically has been cautious in the last few years and picked up two or three or four new shows, is making eight new shows this season.
Right.
They are hoping that if they take more chances, they're going to do. They're borrowing some of cable's playbook. They are announcing shows that are smaller in size. You know, Fox this season had a very big hit with The Following with Kevin Bacon. They only did 15 episodes. They ran all the episodes in a row. That sounds a lot like cable, and it kind of sort of worked. So there could be an evolution there. It could be that you will see fewer 22-episode shows. Certainly on networks like NBC and ABC, which are falling the fastest.
I also feel, I mean, it's partly, I wonder if you agree, a marketing problem, that if shows like The Following or on Fox or The Mindy Project or New Girl, also on Fox, were on a cable channel, they would have more cachet because they weren't on a network, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that there is a perception problem. I mean, network shows can break through, though. A Scandal has broken through in a huge way. The Good Wife for CBS is very tiny ratings, even for CBS, and it's about to go into yet another season. You know, Modern Family broke through in its own way for a while. So it is possible that the network label is not always a curse, but the standard is different for cable. Cable can survive on 2 million viewers, 3 million viewers. I mean, The Americans was a great show that launched this year.
Yep.
A lot of strong buzz. In the overnight ratings, it was losing to repeats of Big Bang Theory on TBS.
Yeah. Joe Adalian is the West Coast editor for Vulture, New York Magazine's culture website. Thank you very much for talking with me today, Joe.
Thank you, sir. There was 57 channels and
nothing on. So, what do you all think? Is network TV doomed sooner rather than later? And what broadcast network shows do you absolutely love? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice that I've been turning over in my mind ever since. Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone, he told me, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had.
You may have heard about the new film adaptation of The Great Gatsby.
Jay, you can't repeat the past.
Can't repeat the past?
No.
Why, of course you can. Of course you can.
If you want to go deeper into Gatsby and what it means, we've got a whole hour on it in our series, American Icons.
It was the miracle of American literature.
The novelist Jonathan Franzen tells us why he reads Gatsby again and again.
Here is somebody who found a way in 50,000 words to tell the central fable of America, and yet you feel like you're eating whipped cream.
Hollywood marketing aside, it really is Gatsby's world we're living in. You can hear our program and all the episodes in our American Icon series at studio360.org/American Icons. Still ahead, a pop opera that invites you to boogie along. whether you want to or not.
I'm someone who does not like interactive theater.
Come on up. Let me humiliate you.
Yeah, exactly. None of that.
I'll talk with Alex Timbers, the brilliant young director of Here Lies Love. That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. I recently attended a 90-minute immersion into the life of a despot's wife. There were no seats, no refreshments, no intermission. There were, however, instructions in karaoke and disco line dancing. I'm talking about Here Lies Love, a brilliant new musical playing in New York right now that's a hybrid dance party and 20th century history lesson. It tells the story of Imelda Marcos, infamous and still living widow of Filipino president-turned-dictator Ferdinand Marcos. David Byrne and Fatboy Slim wrote the music, and it's directed by Alex Timbers, who is here with me now. Alex, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this show was described by the New York Times critic as a theatrical event and a paparetta. If you're on an airplane tomorrow and you meet somebody who doesn't know about theater or Imelda Marcos or David Byrne, how would you describe Here Lies Love?
Well, we knew we wanted it to feel like a nightclub, you know, that Imelda loved to visit Studio 54. She had a disco ball in her apartment and a dance floor in Manila on her roof. And so that was going to be the sort of – that was the idiom for the music, and we thought it should be the sort of like the idiom for the staging. And it just, you know, one of the things that really was a big question for us is how do we involve the audience? I'm someone who does not like interactive theater.
Come on up. Let me humiliate you.
Yeah, exactly. None of that. But how do we justify the concept of it being a club show instead of you being able to see the exact same show just sitting in your seat and watching it? What makes this unique and have to happen this way?
As you say, that you kind of – it is this immersive club-like experience with these multiple moving stages all over the theater and a live pseudo-TV news happening among you as you're there. Mm-hmm. This audience is kind of a wandering mob shoved around the theater. did you ever draw back and say, okay, yeah, we wanted immersion, but this is getting to be too much?
Well, you know, we had certain moments where we pulled back, where we thought, you know, because you want to always feel like you're incredibly safe in the room, you know, even as you're moving around to the different stages to see the performance that's happening on this side of the theater or on that side.
Or being forced to dance, which I thought was going to mortify me as it was happening, but didn't.
Gently encouraged to dance, perhaps. But yes, I know. It's, you know, one of the things we did with that was we darkened the theater. You know, no one wants to sort of be aware of themselves dancing, but they want to have the freedom to it. You know, you're not forced to dance, but that's a great point. You know, we learned that, you know, if we want people to really respond, you got to make sure it's really dark so that everyone
That's
feels
funny.
Anonymous. Yeah.
The music is terrific, but it is not particularly or even recognizably, if you didn't know, David Byrne-ish music. When you first heard it, did it surprise you that this was a new version of David Byrne?
Well, yeah, it doesn't sound like, as you said, like typical David Byrne songs. You know, it stemmed from his collaboration with Fatboy Slim, and so it has a much more kind of, you know, him being a British DJ, it has a much more sort of clubby feel. And I think that's what people love about it. There is a sort of the sense of great irony and great melody that's inherent to David's work, but it feels like something completely new and exotic as well.
And not much irony. One of the things that surprised me was how conventional, in the best sense, this whole thing is. It's a real musical with heart and sentiment. And unlike some stuff, great stuff you've done in the past, not making fun of the genre or the characters. It's all in a kind of earnest way.
Well, I think when you hear there's like a disco musical about Imelda Marcos, you think it's going to be about shoes, or you think it's going to be some sort of, you know, spoofy thing. And we knew we didn't want that at the beginning. You know, David was like, there's no shoes. This ends before the shoes. There's, you know, people wear shoes, but there's no
And I applaud you for not making a shoes joke.
Thank you. But at the same time, you know, there's these sung through musicals. You know, when you think of those like sort of British pop operas from the 80s are very self-serious. And so the question was really tonally, how do you still have fun? How do you still have a sense of irreverence without sending yourself up?
Right.
And so I think there is a sense of irony and irreverence, but there isn't a sense of kind of spoofing the idiom, which I think is an important distinction.
Right. Did David Byrne ever say to you, explain to you what got the bee in his bonnet about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was really interested in the politics of power. And he was interested in, you know, what world leaders come with their own soundtrack. And, you know, he sort of says, well, Henry Kissinger, you know, that guy doesn't – you don't know what music Henry Kissinger would rock out to. Whereas Imelda
– Metallica, you know, I know for a fact.
Yeah, Imelda, you know, she visited Studio 54. She loved club music. And so to him, it was a natural fit.
You are in your early, mid-30s. You were a child, a small child, when Marcos was forced out. How much did you know about the regime and the history of the Philippines?
You know, I didn't know that much. I mean, this has obviously been a sort of an incredible history lesson. And one of the things that I love is that when people leave the show, other than that they, you know, whether they enjoy it or not, is that they're looking up the history. And I think that's pretty cool.
The cast has a lot of performers of Filipino ancestry.
Yeah.
Did you get any notes from them about how to get this note or this culture or this feel of Filipino culture correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, what I think is so cool to these performers is that they're actually getting to tell the story of their parents and their grandparents. And it's this kind of, you know, this is living history. This is an Andrew Jackson, which took place, you know, where it's like 200 years ago. This, as you said, this woman's still alive. And so these experiences are really fresh to people. The order that declared martial law in the Philippines, Order 1081, which is a big story point in our show. The guy who wrote Order 1081's son was at the show last week. I mean, that's a trip.
And with the history of the Philippines after the war through the 80s with Andrew Jackson. You did a musical about Gutenberg. You've become a sort of semi-specialist in surprising shows about history. How did that happen?
I don't know. You know, I wasn't a history major in college, but I guess a fan of Schoolhouse Rock, perhaps. You know, there is a sense of how do you analyze the present by looking at the past, and how do you make the past palatable and fun by crashing together sort of the lowbrow and the highbrow. And I think that Here Lies Love is a real sort of unique version of the mashup.
You are a revisionist.
Thank you.
Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which was your terrific rock musical of a few years ago, drew all kinds of acclaim in its off-Broadway production. It went to Broadway. Now there's this, which, as you say, has been extended several times already. You are the directorial it boy of this moment.
I don't know about that, but thank you. That's very sweet of you to say that.
It's absolutely true. But I'm wondering, to the degree that's true, I'm sure it would be gratifying, but I can imagine it would also be the stuff of anxiety.
The getting to work with people like David Byrne on stuff like this that feels so sort of in the pocket, like in terms of just creating the 360 experiences and things like that. This stuff is the stuff that really gets me going, you know?
And Shakespeare seems to be getting you going. This summer, you are collaborating on with the composer of Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson on a musical version of Love's Labor's Lost in Central Park. Shakespeare is perpetually fiddled with by directors and reinvented and reimagined. That sets a bar higher for doing it in some satisfying new way, doesn't it?
Well, you know, one of the sort of landmark musicals that got me excited about staging musicals was Galt McDermott and John Guare's Two Gentlemen of Verona, which was a musical version of that comedy, which was done in the park 41 years ago. And there hasn't been a Shakespeare musical in the park in that time. And so we got really, you know, along with the artistic director, Oscar Eustace, the idea of taking another sort of lesser performed Shakespeare comedy and sort of seeing, you know, how we could put that into the sort of the musical dimension, which we're really excited about.
You chose a lesser performed one because it's less familiar and therefore you're freer to mess around with it?
I know. You know, it's a little less sacred. It was also something that I really responded to. You know, I love, as you said, talking about academia and history, and Love's Labor's Lost is a show that really takes on, you know, the university life and academia and young people coming of age. And so it felt really on narrative to the sort of themes that I love.
How old were you when you decided that this is what you wanted to do with your life?
It was out of college. I looked around and, I started doing improv comedy and sketch comedy in college and really was interested in the mechanics of comedy. And so I started directing farces. And when you get out of college, no one tells you that there's a sort of this adage that you have to have gray hair to direct, you know, that there's a certain, they don't let young people direct. And so what you end up having to do if you want to, if you want opportunities, you have to create your own opportunities. So I created this company that did work about in this sort of schoolhouse rock form about taking historical and academic subject matter and kind of turning it on its head. And that's been even though that was a downtown experimental theater company, it's been the source of all the opportunities that I have today.
I'm so happy that you're not one of these people who said, yes, at 8, I saw, you know, Equus and I knew that I was going to be a director.
I wish I had that much sense of destiny as a young child.
Alex Timbers, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here Lies Love is playing at New York's Public Theater through the end of June, at least. And Love's Labor's Lost will be at the Delacorte Theater in Central Park starting in late July.
Why don't you love me? Why don't you love me? Why don't you love me? Why don't you love me?
This is your brain.
100 million groups of cells, each with up to 10,000 connections. It's larger than the number of stars in the universe. And so we are very far from getting an intimate picture of what goes on in the brain.
The world's most celebrated neuroscientist, Oliver Sacks, recently turned 80. To mark the occasion, New York University held a 3-day festival of talks and performances inspired by his work. One of the events was a production of a Harold Pinter play that is based on Dr. Sacks. Pinter was a writer who understood the power of silence on stage, but this production is unique. It's performed with no spoken dialogue at all by a cast of deaf actors using American Sign Language. We sent Julia Weatherall to find out what that was like for a hearing audience.
You probably know the story of Oliver Sacks' book Awakenings. In the 1960s, when he was a young doctor, Sacks woke up a hospital ward full of people with a rare type of paralyzing encephalitis. Their bodies had been frozen for decades, but Sacks believed that their minds were still alive. After figuring out which drug to use, turned out he was right. Robin Williams plays a saintly Oliver Sacks in a Hollywood version of Awakenings. There's also a very un-Hollywood version of this story, a play by Harold Pinter called A Kind of Alaska. It focuses on one patient, Deborah. She fell ill as a teenager and wakes up 30 years later as a disoriented middle-aged woman.
Something is happening.
Deborah's brain has been far away in a frozen landscape, the Alaska of the title. A Kind of Alaska is a short play, and when it was revived last month in New York, it was performed twice, back to back. First, there was a traditional Pinteresque interpretation, with long silences between outbursts of speech. The second performance had nothing but silences. But inside that silence, there is a lot going on. Two women are sitting at a table, Deborah and her sister, speaking for the first time in decades. Deaf performance comes from the body, like dance, but with grammar and syntax coming from the hands. That's a huge amount of meaning in subtle movements, like when Deborah turns away from her sister, completely tuning her out.
You know, I think sometimes society just thinks of me as a regular performer. They don't really think about me as an artist because, you know, they're always hearing a voice.
That's deaf actor Tara Lean, who spoke to me through an interpreter. Deaf actors almost always work with some kind of interpretation, which is kind of like being overdubbed in a movie. But A Kind of Alaska was a rare chance for these actors to perform in their native language. The play was performed for a mixed audience of hearing and deaf people, and there was no interpretation for the benefit of the hearing.
One can indicate physical presence and space and dimensions much more vividly in sign language.
That's Oliver Sacks.
And in A Kind of Alaska, the feeling of space being given to Deborah when she wakes and space shrinking on her and contracting, I could imagine could be more powerfully conveyed in sign than in words.
The reason for this production is that Sacks is a major figure in the deaf community. He supported students at Gallaudet University at the famous protest where they demanded for their school to hire a deaf president. He wrote about the protest and then wrote a book called Seeing Voices.
I was walking by the side making notes and someone yanked my arm and signed, "You're with us." And so I marched with them.
Oliver Sacks calls himself a clinical ontologist, which is to say somebody for whom the question, "How are you?" is the clinical question. What is it like to be you? What is being like for somebody like you?
The writer Lawrence Weschler is an old friend of Oliver Sacks. It was his idea that the performance should let sign language stand on its own.
Haven't you had that experience when you go to a bus stop and you're watching two people sign? I find it mesmerizing. I find it, first of all, very beautiful, but it's mesmerizing. And then I feel very embarrassed that I'm staring. But on the evening of this production, that's what you get to do.
I'm suspect, actually, of co-opting ASL and deaf culture in the hearing world. So it was something that I had to really question them about, why they wanted to do this.
Kim Wield is the director of A Kind of Alaska. She's hearing, but uses ASL. This is her third play with deaf actors.
So I got this idea, which was when I looked at the dates that Deborah's asleep, those 30 years are crucial 30 years in the development of sign language.
For the three actors in this production, having that history come across on stage is really significant. They're not translating a script into ASL. They are performing as though the characters are deaf, which is different.
I was watching Oliver Sacks work with his patients and reading about this affliction and how it was a global occurrence.
Alexandria Wales plays Deborah's little sister. Again, the actors are speaking with us through interpreters.
I wondered, did this affect deaf people? I felt like I can produce this play as if I was a deaf person involved in that situation.
A challenge for us as a cast, I think, is that people assume that deaf actors are taking the English script and then simply moving it into sign language, that there is some sort of equivalent.
Lewis Merkin plays the Oliver Sacks role. The character is really different in the spoken and the signed versions of the play. In the spoken version, the doctor calls Deborah from across the room. There's a physical and emotional distance between them.
Do you know me? Can you hear me?
In the ASL performance, he's right at Deborah's bedside, much more intimate.
Well, as a deaf person, you know, she's not hearing anything. A deaf doctor would not be speaking to her. A deaf person would be touched. They would be maybe signing in her hand in a manual way. That is the actual life of a deaf person. And we're trying to honor that and incorporate it into the play.
And Terry Lean, who plays Deborah, was enthusiastic about performing for people who can't actually understand a word that she's saying.
Sometimes I see that people seem to be afraid of me because I don't speak. I don't use my voice to communicate. I use my hands to communicate. So my hope is that through this production, the world that doesn't have exposure to deaf culture will see the play and will let go of their fear. I want to give them permission to experience sign language.
We know that hearing people are sound activated. They are drawn toward the sound of persons' voices, which in a way disconnects them from the actual performance. This is going to give them the opportunity to not be distracted by sound.
That's bold. Merkin thinks that voices distract us from good acting. It's hard to wrap your head around, but it makes sense as a tribute to Oliver Sacks, because his work is all about seeing the world through someone else's radically different perspective.
Seeing a sign is an extraordinary experience. You may first think that it's gesture, and then you rapidly see that it's not gesture, that it's much more intricate. Maybe you think this is how language started. Perhaps before there was speech, there was sign.
For Studio 360, I'm Julia Wetherill.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Still ahead this hour, forget the samba and the bossa nova. The hot new music coming out of Brazil sounds more like a melancholy lullaby.
Desde que o vento passou, rasgou meu pranto, teu casaco. Desde que o vento
deixou, Dom La Nena is ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
E o que o vento levou, ninguém mais se acostumou a viver sem tudo que o vento apagou.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. At the end of last year, we invited you to tell us about your creative New Year's resolutions. We picked four listeners and promised to help get their resolutions accomplished by nagging them all year long. Today, we'll hear again from Arielle Lautman of Silver Spring, Maryland. Her New Year's resolution was to learn woodworking and build some furniture for her family. She spent the winter finishing up her first project, and now that it's warmer outdoors, we thought we'd find out what she's learned so far and what she's planning next.
My first project was making bookshelves for my son's room, and they were sort of shaped like a pocket. And that was the real point of it, was so that he could see his books and not take all of the books off of the shelf and throw them all over his room when he wanted to read a book, but rather find the one book that he wanted. Understanding that he is a toddler and there is some aspect of I'm going to take all the books off the shelf no matter what. And I'm really happy with how it came out. So my first step, I went into my son's room and I measured the space and we sort of visually looked at the room and where things would fit. The second step was to go shopping. So what I decided to do was a harder wood for the bottom, because that was going to sort of bear the brunt of the weight, and a softer, less expensive wood for the sides of the shelf. My third step was cutting everything down to size. So I'm definitely in the measure twice or three times or four times and then make your cuts. And the fourth step was sealing it all together with the screws. The very last part was sanding it down and finishing it. And then I hung it. He likes it. He keeps trying to sort of hang on it. And so we have to say, no, don't hang on the bookshelf that's attached to the wall. I think that what surprised me the most about the process was how much of it seemed like common sense after I had made the mistake. Like when I left one of my drill bits just sitting on the patio, and it had gotten really, really cold, and it just didn't occur to me that the next time that I came out to go drill into the wood, there would be all this friction and things would get warm, and the drill bit would snap because it was cold and brittle from freezing weather. But, you know, there definitely is that learning process of making sure that you have thought through all of the potential repercussions of the different actions, even if it's something as silly as leaving a drill bit outside. I think my ultimate project that I'm really hoping I feel confident enough to tackle this year is to do a breakfast bar for our kitchen area, where we can put one of those clip-on booster seats for my son so that he can sit and watch us cook, because he likes to help, and his helping isn't super helpful all the time. He's really good at unloading the dishwasher, but he is not super good at things like not touching the hot oven. So yeah, that's where I'd like to get to by the end of the year.
You can see photos of Ariel's bookshelf on our website, studio360.org. Dominique Pinto makes music under the name Dom la Nena, which translates, more or less, to Dom the Little Girl, which isn't ironic, more like a perfectly apt brand name. She's 23, petite. She, at least today, is fragrant with patchouli. And she makes this dreamy, delicate pop music. Agora que já sabes o que já pra dizer, por favor, não duvide, pois consegui escrever. As notinhas nunca vão esquecer que eu sempre amei, amei você. De todos os Dom La Nena's first album, Ela, was released earlier this year. It's minimalist pop sung in Portuguese because she spent her childhood in Brazil, and in Spanish because at age 13 she decided she needed to move to Buenos Aires to study cello. And language aside, her music feels a little French.
I moved to France when I was 8 years old, and it was like a very big change in my life, and I was very small. And then when I came back to Brazil, it was another one. And when I went to Argentina, it was bigger, because I went when I was 13 years old, and my parents stay in Brazil. For me, it's like I had like mini lives, you know? So, and I'm always missing someone and missing somewhere.
Right.
I think it's something that it's really present on the album.
I'm so fascinated by this one part of your biography, the you deciding apparently at age 13 to go to Argentina by yourself.
Yeah, because when I was in Paris, I really fell in love with the cello and all the cello repertory, and I really wanted to be cellist. So I worked very hard on it. And when I came back to Brazil, we are from a city where there is not really good school music schools, and at this moment I was really sad, and so we found a solution, and I was really decided that I wanted to do it, and so I moved to Buenos Aires to study, and it was such a big responsibility, but it went really well.
So how and when and why did you get the idea of, wait, I can do pop music and play the cello? Because there's not many models for people having done that.
Yeah. Well, when I moved again to Paris when I was 18 years old, 18 years old, sorry, I was studying on the music school, and then I met a French musical producer. So we became friends, and she said, "Well, I need a cello. Come on, let's try it." And I was very nervous because I only played classical music, so it was the first time I was without score and without a teacher telling me what to do. And it was great. It was really fun, and I realized that I can make like a quartet by myself with with the record.
Well, you start us off with maybe the first song on your album, which is called Anjo Gabriel.
Okay.
That was the singer-songwriter cellist Dom La Nena performing Anjo Gabriel from her album Ella. So that, of course, sounded at various moments like several cellists playing. It was just you recording yourself and looping it with a foot pedal.
Yeah.
Was that something you was new to you and you discovered it and thought, this is awesome? How did that...
Yeah, you can do like many arrangements alone. So... When I discovered the loop pedal, it was like my dream to do like a little orchestra alone.
Well, you clearly you like being alone. Maybe that connects somehow to your love of melancholy.
Yeah,
too. But
I'm
you could
solitary.
You could have a group, but you have it's you. How about you'd played cello for years. How about singing and playing cello?
Yeah, that was another challenge.
I bet.
Because when I started to write the songs, I never had really sing in my life. So if you listen to the demos, it's really strange because I was like discovering my voice and it was like the first time that I listened to my voice. So I started to take singing lessons. And I think even now my voice have changed since the recording.
And did you know right away, you'd never sung before, wow, my voice is great? Or did people tell you, Dom, your voice is great? How did you get the confidence to say, I'm a singer?
Yeah, no, I don't think that my voice is great. But it was, you know, I wrote the songs and I said, okay, now I need to sing it. I had no choice.
Will you play one more song, the title track?
Yeah.
Called Ella.
Yes.
Excellent.
Pode pensar, ela não pode lembrar, não quer nem mencionar no que ficou pra trás, ela não quer olhar, não pode suportar de saber que é assim, todo um dia tem fim e ela nunca foi feliz. Sua vida é feita de ares bons, ares ruins, noites estreladas, noites de luar, nunca o mesmo. Mesmo dia, nunca o mesmo ar. Ela não sabe pra onde é que foi que o vento levou o seu olhar. Ela não quer nem tenta abrir os olhos e ver ao longe o mar. Não consegue escutar, não consegue cantar, não consegue chorar. Sua vida é feita de ares bons, ares ruins, quando na janela, logo ao despertar, fica sufocada e não pode pular. Sua vida é feita de ares bons, ares ruins, noites estreladas, noites de luar, nunca o mesmo dia, nunca o mesmo.
That was Dom La Nena playing Ella, which is the title track of her debut album. So you have all these languages. You've lived all these places. Do any of them feel like home? Where does feel like home?
Well, now my home is in Paris, and it's the city where I live the most part of my life. So I should say that it's Paris, but I missed a lot Brazil, and it's my family home. So I'm like between Brazil and France, maybe on the ocean.
So you were sort of raised, you were created to be feel like an exile, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, when you're a musician, you are always traveling, and I think you became yourself your home because you're never at home, actually.
I read in a recent interview you gave that you never sent your music to your great cello teacher, Christine Walewska.
No, I'm too shy.
Well, but and you said in the same interview that you were going to hand her a CD when you're in New York.
I know.
Have you done it yet?
No.
Why?
I'm shy.
Because you think she'll think what?
I don't know.
That you've abandoned the classical music?
No, I love her so much, and I really wish that she liked the album and my music, but I am too scary about it. I don't know.
Well, maybe we can call her and she can listen to this when it's on the radio.
Well.
That scares you, huh?
Yes. But yeah, if you do it, Christine, I love you, and I really wish that you you liked my music.
Dominique Pinto, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Can you, on the spur of the moment, maybe perform a kind of instrumental to be our theme song as we end the show today?
Okay.
Great. Dom La Nena's first album is Ayla. It came out earlier this year, and she will be touring North America this summer. You can watch a video of her playing for us at our website, studio360.org. And that is it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Chloe Plant,
Anne Hepperman,
Shannon Geis,
Julia Lowry Henderson.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. And you can find out everything that's happening at Studio 360 by subscribing to our weekly newsletter. You can do that at studio360.org.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, helping others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. Scion's Motivate program helps young entrepreneurs take their business to the next level. In March, Scion selected 10 semifinalists and will track their success over the next 3 months. Learn more at scion.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360,
it is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury.
Alan Cumming is playing Macbeth on Broadway.
Come to my woman's breasts and take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers.
And Lady Macbeth. And every other role in the play. Alan Cumming joins me next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.